You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. It's the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. A sweet shop called Fugetsudo sells mochi and manju and other Japanese treats on First Street in LA's Little Tokyo neighborhood. Brian Keto's family's run this business for 116 years, except for a brief period during World War II when the family was interned in a camp for Japanese Americans. Well, after the war, his father restarted that business thanks to the Japanese American community, who lent them money and then later provided construction services on credit when they had to relocate.
Fugetsudo didn't restart and didn't succeed by itself. It had a lot of different people along the way that actually helped it reach this 116 years.
Brian is the third generation owner of Fugetsudo. He caters to a clientele as diverse as Little Tokyo itself, from Japanese Americans with deep roots in the community to tourists and to young, well-paid professionals who flock to Little Tokyo since downtown LA's revitalization.
A little manju store like mine, a little mochi store, candy store, we get from top to bottom. That's why I guess it's so easy for me to relate to everyone of the spectrum. There's no being arrogant in our business. We get all different styles and levels of customers.
Like lots of places in LA, rents here are going up and Little Tokyo is gentrifying. Small businesses that have been here for a long, long time, most of them Japanese-owned, like Fugetsudo, worry they're going to be priced out. So the Japanese-American community here is trying something new. They're starting an investment fund that they hope to use to buy back their neighborhood. Reporter Phoenix So tells us how it works.
Little Tokyo resident Steve Nagano watched what happened to Rafu Busan, a local Japanese art and gift shop in Little Tokyo that operated for more than 60 years.
Rents went up, the building went up for sale, and Shoe Palace moved in, and they moved into like a space that is like maybe about 1/6, 1/7 of the size they had before.
This has happened to a lot of businesses in Little Tokyo. Rents are constantly increasing, and now the neighborhood is anticipating LA Metro's new regional connector station, which is expected to drive rents up even more. So last year, Steve and his wife Patty gathered a few community leaders in their living room, and the group decided to start an investment fund to buy real estate. The fund's president is Bill Watanabe, the founding executive director of the Little Tokyo Service Center.
We were talking about what can we do to kind of deal with all this gentrification. And the mantra that we came with was, you know, if you don't own it, you can't control it.
Here's the idea. Little Tokyo residents and business owners put together at least $2 million and collectively they buy a local building. Then they charge below market rents to their selected tenants.
We want to make enough money that our investors will get some rate of return. Maybe not the best ever, but some rate of return that's going to make it worth their while. But at the same time, I'd be able to provide a community benefit.
If anybody can pull it off, it would be them, says Paul Ong, professor emeritus at UCLA.
They certainly have the credibility of carrying this off. So the final question is that how will other stakeholders respond to this? You know, will they be able to get enough investors?
The fund has raised $350,000 since August. That's a lot in a short time, but it's not $2 million. And then there's a tricky business of identifying which businesses to support.
In many ways, you have to factor in things that normal businesses would not think about. That is, what is the cultural value, for example, of these businesses? What do they represent symbolically?
Little Tokyo's investors were inspired by a program in San Francisco. That program helps small businesses that have been around for at least 30 years and contribute to their community's history and identity. By that definition, a business like Fugetsudo is a no-brainer. But what about other businesses that aren't necessarily Japanese-owned and have also been around for a while? The neighborhood is near Men's Central Jail. Bail bond businesses have also been in the neighborhood a long time.
I don't know if we would consider them culturally significant.
Alan Nishio is an investor in the fund. He says that any business is eligible if they relate to the values of the Japanese community and contribute to preserving it for the future.
You want people that are owning small businesses to be, you know, kind of stakeholders in our community, and we're less concerned if they are shish kebab shops or coffee shops, et cetera, then we're concerned that they not be the Starbucks of the world and McDonald's, et cetera.
Beyond cultural value, the fund has to grapple with the market. The new metro station might bring in more foot traffic, but will those customers want to shop at these Japanese businesses?
I have a good shot, I guess. We're a candy store, so most people can eat candy. Certain little mom-and-pop gift shops or certain mom-and-pop restaurants, can they survive?
Brian Kito says ultimately whether Little Tokyo retains its Japanese character depends on both Little Tokyo's shoppers and Kito's own children and their peers.
You can simulate all you want, and yet, you know, if you're Japanese-American, you still have a Japanese heart. Somewhere along the way, you're connected to this district, whether it was your grandparents or great-grandparents. And so I think it's very important for us all to do our part and stay involved with this community. If the later, younger generations don't care about it, then so be it. It'll be gone.
For KCRW, I'm Phoenix So.
Coming up, having a baby premature by 3 months is super stressful, right? How about getting a bill for that for $1.7 million? That story just ahead on KCRW's Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. Welcome back. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Imagine that you've just had a baby, and that baby comes 3 months premature, and both of you have to spend time recovering in the hospital. When you and the baby are back home, then you get a bill from the hospital for nearly $900,000. That's exactly what happened to Lauren Bard, who ironically is an emergency room nurse at another hospital, St. Bernardine Medical Center in San Bernardino. If nothing else, her story exemplifies an American healthcare system that is prohibitively expensive and a for-profit health insurance industry linked to employment with all the holes and loopholes and fine print that can leave people with large bills, which is apparently what happened in Lauren Bard's case. She joins us on the line right now. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. Marshall Allen is a reporter for ProPublica, and Marshall wrote about Lauren's story. Hi, Marshall.
Hi, thanks for having us here today.
Welcome to you both. I mean, Lauren, I want to start with you. First of all, is everything okay with the baby? Because 3 months premature is pretty early.
Yeah, she's doing really well. No longer on oxygen, and she's hitting all her milestones. She's crawling, she's pulling herself up, and, you know, she's thriving. She's doing really good.
You, and that's great news. You and your daughter were in the hospital for a while. It's not the hospital where you work, right? To be clear.
No, we were at UC Irvine.
Did you expect to get a big bill, or did you think that all of this would be covered by insurance?
That was the assumption at first. You know, I figured everything was going to be covered by insurance. I've always had insurance. I'm very on top of everything. So it was not expected for this to be the outcome of what was to come.
This is insurance that you had through your employer, through St. Bernardine Medical Center, right?
Yes.
And your daughter, she was in the neonatal intensive care unit, right, for a long period of time?
Yeah, we were there for 105 days.
So, all right, you get home, and you know, at things, knock wood, things are they're turning for the better, and you get a bill. What did the bill say, and what was your reaction?
Well, the first couple were, you know, a couple $100, $1,000, then in I think March or May, we got like a $17,000 bill, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's gonna keep increasing, because at this point we knew that we were having trouble with the insurance and she wasn't going to be covered. And then just this last month, I had gotten a bill for almost $900,000.
Oh. All right. Well, you just said the keywords, and I'm going to bring Marshall into the conversation. She wasn't going to be covered. What does that mean, Lauren? She wasn't going to be covered.
Okay. So after I gave birth, 3 days after, I called Anthem Blue Cross, which is my insurance. So I let them know that I had the baby, and I figured that was all I needed to do at the time. My problem was through my company, through Dignity Health, I had to also add her onto our online employee portal as a life event, which I did not do. So in turn, Dignity did not cover my daughter.
In the interest of full disclosure, Dignity Health is also an underwriter here at KCRW. We need to mention that. I want to ask you, Marshall, because you did this story. How did you find out about it? I mean, did someone reach out to you?
Well, I found out about this through an advocate who's kind of an expert in billing, Don Cornelis, who was working with Lauren to help her with these bills. Because what happened is, you know, the health plan had a 31-day deadline to go on their HR kind of web portal and enroll the baby in the plan officially. And Lauren and the baby's father, her fiance, were, you know, pretty consumed with Lauren's health issues. And the baby was in the NICU for 105 days. So it was really, at times, the doctors gave the baby a 50-50 chance of living. This is Sadie, is the baby's name. And when they rejected the baby from the plan, this was like day 39, Anthem and UC Irvine were saying, hey, the baby's not on the plan. We're trying to process the bills and there's some kind of a problem. And Lauren called Dignity Health and Dignity said, well, you missed the deadline. You had 31 days and it's now day 39. So you're too late and there's nothing we can do. She actually made two written appeals to Dignity, and they rejected them both. And Dignity told her, we're not allowed, you know, even the federal law, IRS guidelines do not allow us to make any exception to add the baby to the plan. And of course, you know, there were lots of pleading phone calls.
I mean, this is not just, you know, $1,000 or a couple thousand dollars. This could bankrupt you for the rest of your life, right, Lauren?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Close to $1 million. So I guess, what were those conversations like when you're thinking of all that at the same time? New child, NICU, you know, not sure about survival, things like that. And you're on the phone with Dignity talking to them about, you know, missing 8 days.
Yeah. Honestly, it's insane. Like, That was just one of our bills, but our grand total was $1.7 million.
Oh,
and, you know, calling them, I'm like, surely they'll understand. They'll listen to my story and the circumstances. Like, they'll have some compassion. And when I called the benefit center, they were very cold and harsh and just didn't really, you know, want to give me much help. They're like, nope, this is how it is. We can't change anything. Like, you're going to have to appeal it, and that's it. And then when I got both of those denied appeals, it's like, you know, what is my family going to do? Like, we've already been, sorry, I don't want to get emotional. My family's been through a lot. And
take your time.
Sorry. I just don't understand how they can honestly do that to people, especially when, you know, I really thought I was on top of it. So I felt a lot of guilt.
You felt like it was your fault because you weren't on top of it, but you were a little busy at the time too.
Oh yeah. And, you know, just going through everything in the NICU is unimaginable. You know, you see your tiny baby in like a little plastic box, like at least in our daughter's case, you can't touch her. You know, she had hemorrhages in her lungs. She had three holes in her heart. You know, there were lots of things going on. And on top of it, I'm trying to recover as well. And then I had to go back to the ER maybe like 2 weeks after I was discharged because I had an infection. There's just a lot of things going on all at once. But I don't know. I just wish they kind of showed some more compassion, to be honest.
What was Dignity's response, Marshall, when you questioned them about their protocol in a situation like this?
Well, you know, it's kind of sad because, you know, Lauren appealed to them twice in writing and through multiple phone calls. But as soon as I contacted them, I sent them an email, and the very next day, one of the Dignity executives called Lauren personally and said, "Oh, we're so sorry to hear about this. And, oh, we want to make sure and help you." And, you know, it's really encouraging. It's encouraging that they decided to take action. But, you know, they were very responsive, but unfortunately they were responsive to the media contacting them, rather than their own employees.
Yeah. That goes from HR to PR, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And so Dignity did respond swiftly once I contacted them, and they managed to find a way to put the baby on the plan, which is exactly what they could have done from the beginning and spared Lauren and her family a lot of trauma and a lot of heartache, you know, dealing with this, the huge weight of these bills.
What do you say, Lauren? You're an emergency room nurse. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're sort of on the front lines every day with people who come in who may have the same kind of anxiety about healthcare bills and things like that. Does this give you sort of a fresher perspective on what's going on in the healthcare industry?
Oh, it definitely does. You know, I've had coworkers reach out to me. I've had random people on Facebook reach out to me, like letting me know, like, they've been in a similar situation, or, you know, what kind of tips can I give them, or how can I help them? So hopefully with this story, and you know, people will really start looking out for themselves and not put so much trust, I guess, in these insurance companies because they're not looking out for you.
How much did you wind up paying?
I think like maybe like $2,000
total.
Yeah, because
but the bill was $1.7 million.
Mm-hmm.
You can almost buy a fixer upper in LA for that, can't you?
That's right.
Yeah.
Marshall Allen, reporter for ProPublica. His story, by the way, is up now. How one employer stuck a new mom with a big bill for her premature baby. Marshall, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Lauren Bard, emergency room nurse at St. Bernardine Medical Center in San Bernardino. New mom, too, by the way. And we're glad that she's okay, too, that both of you are okay. Thank you for your time. By the way, we reached out to Dignity for a statement about this story. They have not yet responded to KCRW, but it did tell ProPublica in a statement that it would review how it could better educate new parents about the enrollment requirement. And in a follow-up, told Lauren Bard in a letter, quote, "We based this new decision on certain extenuating and compelling circumstances which, in all likelihood, prohibited you from enrolling your newborn daughter within the plan's required 31-day enrollment period." Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Todd Gray is an LA-based artist known for his photography and for his sculpture. And if you haven't heard his name, it's likely you've at least seen his work. He was Michael Jackson's personal photographer in the 1980s, responsible for many of the images chronicling the King of Pop's early rise out of the Jackson 5 and into his mainstream pop career. Well, outside of Gray's photography, he specializes in examining the legacies of colonialism in Europe and in Africa. And now, the Pomona College Museum of Art is exhibiting an evolving selection of those photographs. And Lindsay Preston-Zappas is here to talk about it. She's our art insider at KCRW and founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles. Hi, Lindsay.
Hey, Steve.
So now this show is at Pomona College. It's titled Euclidean Gris.
Yes.
What does that mean? I suspect some French there, right?
Yes. Yeah. So Euclidean he's used the word Cartesian in previous exhibitions to get at this sort of Western European logical way of thinking. And then gri-gri is an African word that is sort of like a talisman or good luck charm and is sort of related to voodoo and juju. And we think more about sort of like a bodily response. So he talks about Euclidean being head up, and then the gri-gri being sort of neck down, this sort of intuitive bodily response.
And they all sort of meld together.
Yeah, and so I think so much of what Todd does is try to find the place in between those two and kind of contrast those two.
Is there a piece, Lindsay, in Euclidean gri-gri,
yeah,
that's a good example of the Western and the African cultures being sort of juxtaposed, that you know, like,
yeah,
the Euclidean, the top up and the bottom down?
Right. So a lot of his photographs, he's stacking photographs on top of each other, and he's directly contrasting images of European gardens and these very highly manicured gardens with sort of African landscapes and images of African diaspora. So in one, he shows a beautiful statue, and he told me that it's at the gates of Versailles, this beautiful statue that really signifies like, oh, this is the 1% past this gate, right? Yeah. And then he contrasts that on top of a really kind of beautiful and more wild-looking African landscape. So again, kind of that split between body and mind.
And the colonialism was, of course, you had in France.
Yes, that's another key, is he's photographing gardens and statues in Europe, specifically in places that have benefited from slave labor.
Right. Did he tell you what got him into these themes? I mean, what got him thinking about this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, so much of it is autobiographical for him, being African-American and highly, highly educated in art and in Western thought. And so there was a moment, you know, where he's making this work and he realized, as a Black man in America, oh my gosh, my own mind has been colonialized and my own way of thinking has been influenced by this kind of Western education.
In some of his more recent work, he incorporates the old photographs of Michael Jackson. Is he playing on the idea of identity when he does that?
Yeah, so back in school, he was sort of afraid to talk about his time with Michael Jackson in sort of a fine art context. And he had a professor that encouraged him, like, no, use this. Like, you can look into these mass archives of images of Michael Jackson and really use that to talk about race and class and identity. And so he began to sort of use Michael and think about him almost as rejecting his own Blackness or trying to become more European or more kind of Westernized. And so I think in the work, those images come through as almost a symbol of that idea of sort of rejecting your own identity and going towards something else.
And that was something that he felt happened to himself.
Personally. Yeah. So it almost becomes a signifier for himself.
I had no idea that I had been so compromised and that I had an actual inferiority complex, and that the basis and at the base of it was mental colonialism, and that I'm a second class citizen. And it just opened up a Pandora's box of issues that I was unaware of.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
I know.
And it is something. I mean, we look at our ancestry, we go way back, right? And we think about those things that sort of drive us and identity for sure.
Yeah.
You can't talk about Michael Jackson without talking about child molestation accusations that swirled around him. He fought those criminal accusations in court. He was exonerated in 2005 in Santa Barbara. But he did pay civil judgments to the families of those who accused him. Todd was in pretty close quarters with Jackson.
Sure.
If he was taking pictures of the King of Pop during his musical career. When you talked to Todd Gray, did he have anything to say about those accusations?
You know, Steve, I didn't personally push him on that issue. This is an interview I did for my podcast, The Carla Podcast, and I really wanted to keep the conversation more focused on his art these ideas of colonialism within his own work and how Michael Jackson kind of fits into that without bringing MJ's biography and kind of putting that onto Todd.
The exhibition is up over at the Pomona College Museum of Art. Lindsay Preston-Zapp is founder and editor-in-chief of Contemporary Art Review Los Angeles, our art insider as well. And if you'd like to sign up for that weekly art insider newsletter, check out kcrw.com/greaterLA. Lindsay, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
And that's going to do it for us today. Tomorrow, turns out you can come and stay in America if you have enough dough and you invest it. Next on KCRW, it's all the president's lawyers. And good Lord, what a day for it. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. We invite you to subscribe to the podcast where you can come along on our journey across Greater LA and Southern California. And also you can tell your smart speaker to play KCRW. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Brandon Devine, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl, all essential to making this show happen. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ear and for your time today. Have a great day.